welcome in everyone to Fitzy and Lions. I'm John Lyons. Fitzy will be joining us in just a little bit. We have a lot to get to on this evening's program. We'll be here until just about 6 o'clock or so. If you want to join us at all, 617-779-7937. Of course, you have the text line available. We're going to be talking a lot about Patriots-Dolphins tomorrow. We're going to talk quite a bit about the Hall of Fame as Robert Kraft has once again been left out. But there are some other Patriots greats from the dynasty years who are eligible to be inducted into the Hall of Fame in Canton. We're going to talk a little bit of Bruins because they did have their first game under new head coach Joe Sacco on Thursday night. But I want to start with the Boston Celtics and their win last night. Before I go any further, though, we're here with Tom Crisafulli, producer. Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing great, John. And you're one of the few people who can get the last name correct. So I'm static about that.
So the reason, do you know the reason why, Tom?
No clue.
So when I was coaching, for those that don't know, I spent 8 years as a college football coach. A little humble brag there. But when I was coaching, I had a kid play for me that had the same last name as you, Tom. So I had plenty of practice with it. No relation to you, but plenty of practice.
No, no relation at all. I have a very small family on my dad's side. What are the odds? Small world.
Yeah, and of course, if anyone asks you, you can just say, I'm the best host on EEI and I'm your favorite person. And that's why I got it right, of course.
Yep. But.
And also, too, before I go any further, shout out to BC Football and head coach Bill O'Brien. They make a quarterback change a couple weeks ago. They now are bowl eligible with their huge win over North Carolina today. So credit to them and that program. What Bill O'Brien is really, you know, taken from Jeff Hafley and built forward in just the span of a year. So I'm going to really look forward to them playing in whatever bowl game they end up playing in, but happy for them that they are bowl eligible. They've certainly earned it. I was at that BC Syracuse game a couple weeks ago. That is an awesome environment when Boston College football is playing well, and it's great to see them playing well down the stretch here. But I mentioned I wanted to start with the Boston Celtics. They beat the Washington Wizards 108-96 last night in a game that was a lot closer than that 12-point margin. They got their second win in the NBA Cup, and I have to say, if you care about the NBA Cup, I would love to take your phone call or see your text message in, because I don't know. I thought the NBA Cup last year for the Celtics was valuable because you had Porzingis, you had Holiday, these new guys kind of fitting together, and I thought that could give them some crunch time minutes during the regular season that maybe were at least a little bit higher stakes than, say, your typical regular season game. But now that they've gotten past that and they're defending NBA champions, this NBA Cup doesn't do it for me, man. Like, you have 82 regular season games. Just show up and play the 82 regular season games. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being naive on that, but the NBA Cup does not do it for me. So if you like the NBA Cup, though, I'd be happy to hear about it. And if you don't and you agree with me, I'd be even happier to hear about that. But last night's game, whether you like or dislike the NBA Cup, this was a real rock fight for the Celtics. Again, they win by 12, beat a two-win Wizards team. So on the surface, you might say, well, they really didn't play that great, and they kind of struggled to beat a two-win team. And there's some truth to that. I mean, Jason Tatum was 0 of 10 from three-point range. 0 of 10, 16 points. He did extend his streak to 55 consecutive games of 15 or more points scored thanks to two late free throws, but 0 of 10 from 3. Jaylen Brown, 3 of 13 from 3-point range, but Jaylen Brown had 31 points, 11 rebounds, and 5 assists. Overall, outside of the 3-point issues, I thought Jaylen Brown was terrific in this game. Washington, too, been a terrible defensive team all year, but the Celtics just weren't hitting shots. 23.9% from three in this game. That from the field, 42%. So I look at this game is one of those that, in the grand scheme of things throughout the NBA season, no one's really going to look back on this game as anything significant. No one's going to care that they won their second NBA Cup game on November 22nd in Washington, D.C. I mean, this wasn't even the most interesting thing the Celtics did in Washington. That was when they went to the White House on Thursday. That was a lot more interesting than most of what the Celtics did in this game. But the reason I wanted to start here is I think this is one of those wins that, again, the Celtics didn't play that well, especially offensively, but it could be a sneaky, valuable win long-term, right? Because this was a game that the Wizards were actually up 2 at half, 51-49. Celtics really clamped down defensively. This was only the second time all year the Celtics held an opponent to under 100 points. But the reason I say it's a sneaky, valuable game is you have Cleveland. And earlier this week, Tuesday night, I was on air with KJ Carson while the Celtics were beating the Cavs. And that was a game that Celtics got up. They were up by 21. Cleveland battled all the way back, made it a couple-score game late. Celtics end up just pulling away at the end and winning. So they give the Cavs their first loss, drop the Cavs to 15-1. Of course, Celtics moved to 12-3. But the Cavs followed that up by winning another game, and they're now 16-1. Celtics are 13-3. And I know you might be thinking, hey, it's November 23rd. Who gives a crap about the standings right now? In fairness, I get it. But you look around the Eastern Conference, and teams are kind of settling in, I feel like, to who they are. Cleveland is legit. They're 16-1, and I know going into that Celtics game, I think they had played the third easiest schedule in the NBA, third or fourth. Don't quote me, but it was definitely near the bottom as far as easiest schedules in the NBA. But they had beaten the Lakers. They had beaten Golden State pretty handily. They give the Celtics a tough game, especially late. So Cleveland, to me, they're legit. We obviously know the Celtics are a great team. Not only 13-3 now, but they were defending champs, and they don't even have Porzingis back yet. But you look at the rest of this Eastern Conference. The Knicks are the third seed. They're 9-6. And remember how poorly the Knicks started this year? They've battled back now, and they're sitting at 9-6. Maybe they're starting to figure some things out. I mean, again, it's tough to tell. I was not a big fan of that Karl Anthony Towns trade. I wonder if that'll end up being a net negative. And really, that was just their answer to Kristaps Porzingis, and I still think Porzingis is a better player than Karl Anthony Towns, but I am wearing a green shirt right now, so that might color it a little, but the numbers kind of back that up a little bit. But you look at their last four games, I mean, this Knicks team, look, they've beaten Brooklyn twice, okay, no big deal there. They beat Washington, no big deal there. They do beat Phoenix, though, and I think that's a valuable win, beating Phoenix earlier this week. I believe they play at Utah tonight, but again, Phoenix, to me, is a legit NBA Finals contender, but in this game, I believe Kevin Durant did not play, so the Knicks took advantage of it, and I'll give them credit for that. But the Knicks are kind of settling in, maybe rebounding a little bit from their bad start, and then you have Orlando, which Orlando has given the Celtics problems in the past. They're the third team now in the East with double-digit wins. They're 10-7, and of course, after that, the rest of the East, not so great. You know, Milwaukee's there at 7-9. Maybe they're bouncing back a little bit. Philadelphia way down at the bottom. I was so wrong about those guys. I thought they were going to be an actual threat to the Celtics. I feel like a bozo for that take there. But Tom, Chris Cifulli, are you concerned at all about the Knicks, the Magic, kind of creeping up on the Celtics during this stretch coming up?
Not really. I think I knew the Knicks were going to start slow. Whenever you have such a big roster move, like moving Julius Randle and DiVincenzo for Karl Anthony Towns, it takes a while to adjust to that, get the chemistry going. On top of that, they added Mikal Bridges as well. So there's going to be some chemistry issues early on in the season. So now picking it up, it's just they're figuring it out. They're putting the piece together. And with Orlando, not too worried either because Paolo Banchero is out for a little while as well with an injury. So I'm not too worried about the Wagners coming out and pulling off a 10-game win streak, the two of them. I'm not too worried about any team in the East. I actually would go back to something you said. I think Kat's a better player than Porzingis, John. I really do. And it all comes down to availability. I love Kristaps Porzingis. However, he's very injury-prone and Kat has his problems. He's as soft as a baby's butt on the court, but he's playing games. And when it comes down to it, that's what matters the most to me, is availability is the best ability, John.
Yeah, and I think, look, Tom, that's a fair point. I think you look at their numbers, they average almost identical points per game, rebounds per game, assists per game. Kat is a little bit better shooter from three-point range, 41.6%, but on catch-and-shoot threes, they're almost identical. Porzingis had a better net rating, better offensive rating if you buy into that stuff. Actually, what I think separates them really, and I didn't realize this until I started doing some research on it, Porzingis is actually a much better post player than Karl Anthony Towns. Last year on post-ups, 1.3 points per possession, 7th in the NBA. It was like almost 2/10 of a point better than Karl Anthony Towns. So I get your point, Tom, about the availability. I think when they're both out there, though, I take Porzingis. But the reason I say again, a sneaky important win. You're still trying to keep pace with Cleveland. You don't want to fall 4 or 5 games behind them. And look, I'm not that worried about the Celtics going on the road for a Game 5 or a Game 7 against Cleveland, say, in a conference final. But I sure as heck would rather have that game at home. Like, I don't want to make it any harder than I have to, especially, again, if Porzingis is not fully healthy later on. But also, the schedule coming up for the Celtics here. Because, look, they're 13-3. They've played largely great basketball. That Atlanta loss was pretty bad. But other than that, they've played really good basketball. Their other two losses were close. But they've only played one Western Conference team so far, and that was Golden State, who they lost to 118-112. And I think myself and really everyone else that talks about the NBA or cares about it would look at the West and say that's the much better conference. Golden State, of course, is up at the top there, but Oklahoma City's a legit title contender. The Lakers and Nuggets and Suns look like they might be legit title contenders. I'm not so sure about the Rockets, but they are 12-5. I'll tip my cap to them and Ime Udoka on that. But coming up, the Celtics are actually going to have to play some teams from the West and some good Eastern Conference teams. They have Minnesota tomorrow at 3:30 p.m., so if you're watching the Patriots game and you get frustrated and want to switch over to something, Celtics-Wolves at 3:30. And then they have a back-to-back. Monday night they play the Clippers. And look, I'm not a huge believer in the Clippers, but that is still a solid Western Conference team. I don't think they're a championship contender because you can never depend on Kawhi's health, but they have 10 wins and they're a solid team in the West. And then after a November 29th game against Chicago, next Sunday they play Cleveland once again. So this is a key stretch here. So to win this game against Washington, you don't have a letdown following the Cleveland game. You set yourself up to hopefully go into the Minnesota game with some momentum and the Clippers game after that. Because once you start playing these teams, Minnesota, LA, Cleveland next Sunday, and even if you want to include Milwaukee and Memphis December 6th and 7th, I know Milwaukee, obviously, we know they've sputtered to begin the year, but eventually I feel like they're going to figure it out. They're 7-9 right now. They still have Giannis. They still have Dame. And Memphis, look, they're 9-7 right now, but I think a lot of people forget. A couple of years ago, they were the one seed in the West. So now that they're healthier and they're playing better basketball and they don't have so many of the off-court distractions, by the time you get to that December 7th game, that's going to be a tough game. And you have, and of course, then you have the in-season tournament, all that stuff that we don't really care about. Again, if you do care, feel free to call in and let me know. I cannot get into the in-season tournament. But again, with this stretch of games coming up for the Celtics, I think this win in Washington was sneaky important. I want to see, how do the Celtics do in this back-to-back Minnesota and the Clippers? Because they ran through the playoffs last year. They were 16-3, and I'm not saying they weren't tested at all. Dallas was a good team. Indiana, I know it was a sweep, but 3 out of those 4 games were close. That's still a really good team that did beat the Celtics earlier this season. But I want to see them get tested by some Western Conference teams because they only played one, like I said, Golden State. They lose a close one. How are they going to fare against Anthony Edwards, a guy who has called himself the number one option on Team USA, who, once the Wolves beat the Nuggets last year in Game 7, felt like a lot of pundits were crowning as the best young player in the NBA, like Tatum and Brown, weren't just sitting there as the one seed with the Celtics. But, hey, I want to see how they play against a Minnesota team like that. And, by the way, we talked about the Karl Anthony Towns trade to the Knicks. This is also a revamped Minnesota team because of that trade. And they're only 8-7, but they still have Anthony Edwards. Like, there's still some stuff there that I think can give the Celtics at least some problems. And then again, the Clippers, again, I don't trust them long term, but it's a solid Western Conference team. So can the Celtics stand up to these teams out West? I think they can, but I want to see it happen. Because what's going to happen this season is the East is going to have Boston, Cleveland, Orlando, and probably one other team. Maybe it'll be Milwaukee. Maybe it'll be the Knicks. Maybe it'll be Miami rebounding. I don't know, but I think it's going to be Celtics, Cleveland, Orlando, and then one other team is going to be a threat in the East, or at least a good team in the East. It's really going to be that. Whereas in the West, you have good teams top to bottom, just about. I mean, you look out West. Again, I'm not going to go through the whole standings, but you have good teams almost top to bottom out West. So what I want to see is when the Celtics get those opportunities against those good teams, can they stand up, right? Can they play well? I think they can, but I want to see it, especially without Porzingis. We saw them last year. They went, I think, what, 21-5 without Porzingis. They won multiple NBA Finals games largely without Porzingis. He got hurt in Game 2, didn't play that much in Game 5. They won Game 3 totally without him. So I want to see how do they fare with Porzingis against some of these good teams in the West, because as Tom noted, as much as we love Porzingis, I think he's the most unique player in Celtics history. I didn't say the best. I said most unique. But maybe they're going to have to play some playoff games without him or some key games down the stretch. So how do they hang with him not there? How does Nemus Kata stand up, or Luke Kornet stand up to Minnesota, to the Clippers, to a second Cleveland game December 1st, to Memphis, right? The good teams in the East and these teams out West. I want to see how the Celtics stand up to them. I just think it would be really, to me, that's the interesting thing to watch, because we came into the season saying, oh, the Celtics are going to run through everyone, especially opening night. They can win 70 games. And they're the best team in the NBA. I still think 70 wins is in play. I still think they're going to run through a lot of teams. But I do want to see them get tested at times during the regular season, because you and I know they will get tested at times in the postseason, whether it's kind of the Indiana series, or even though it's a sweep, they had to win one game in overtime, have an 18-point comeback in another, win a third game on a last-minute shot by Derek White, or maybe it's a series that goes 6 or 7. Because I think if you face Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals, that's a 6-game series, and at least 5 out of the 6 games are hard-fought. I think if you go to the NBA Finals and you face OKC, that's going to be a legit 6-game series, maybe 7. Maybe Golden State's going to fit that category as well. They look like a different team this year. And obviously, look, I know Denver is, I don't want to say falling off, but they're not the terror to the league that they were a couple years ago. Still a great team, and Jokic is the best individual player in the NBA. So they are going to get tested, probably at multiple points in the playoffs, but at least one. So I want to see how do they handle these tests, especially from the good Western Conference teams coming up over this next month, right? I mentioned you have Minnesota, LA coming up, Memphis early in December. Then they have Minnesota and Houston and Oklahoma City and Denver, 4 games in a row in January. January 2nd, 3rd, 5th, and 7th. And I'm not going to get that far ahead of ourselves, but just keep that on your mind, Celtics fans. These are valuable games for the Celtics, which, again, is why I think that win against the Wizards, although the Celtics played really poorly offensively. Again, Tatum 0 for 10 from 3. Man, just brutal. But, again, sneaky, valuable win.
So, John, if I could, I want to touch on something you just mentioned right there, if that's okay. Yeah. So you just mentioned Tatum 0 for 10 from 3. I think that's why the Wizards game, even though the Wizards aren't the most impressive team, was, as you said, a sneaky important win. Because down the stretch, if you watch the game, they weren't relying on the three ball in the clutch to get points. Jaylen Brown, Tatum, they were playing back to the basket, taking long twos, mid-range jump shots, and attacking the basket. And I think proving that they can win games beyond just shooting the lights out from behind the arc, but driving to the basket, playing with their back to the basket, and scoring old-style basketball, I think is equally as important. Because I know Joe Mazzulla, his philosophy, shoot as many three balls as you can, because the math's there. But sometimes in the game, you just don't have it. We saw it last night. Tatum, as you said, 0 for 10. Brown, 3 for 13. Just, they're big guys. Back down the smaller guards, get the switch, run the pick and roll, take the long twos, the mid-range jump shots, because they can hit those shots. I think why the Wizards game was very important, John.
And I would agree with that, too. And I think that's something the Celtics showed they could do in the NBA Finals against the Mavs. We all remember how poorly Tatum shot from 3, but he had, what, double-digit assists in Game 2, double-digit rebounds in Game 5. He almost had a triple-double in Game 5. So we have seen evidence that we can do it. And with the Celtics' philosophy, look, you shoot enough threes, you're going to win most of your games. But to what Tom was saying, there's going to be individual nights where that doesn't work, and can you still win on those individual nights? You look at, to me, arguably the 3 biggest shots of this game were all 2-point shots. Jaylen Brown with that really impressive layup with 2:50 to go to put the Celtics up by 6. Jaylen Brown, of course, is ending rainbow 2-point shot with 46 seconds to go, and then there was that one Tatum hit in the middle. I think there were 2.5 minutes left to put the Celtics up by 8. So those are the 3 biggest shots, arguably, of the game. They were all 2-point shots. So I'm a fan of the 3. I mean, I'm all in on the Celtics philosophy. I think it works. I think we saw last year that it can work if you have good enough 3-point shooters. Obviously, we saw with the Warriors that it can work 4 times to win 4 championships. But there's going to be individual nights where your Tatum is 0 for 10 from 3. Your team is 23.9%, and that's not going to win you the game. Can you win those games? And the Celtics did last night. And speaking of maybe sneaky important games, or maybe not so sneaky important games, the Boston Bruins won their first game under new head coach Joe Sacco on Thursday. I'm going to touch on that for a few minutes. Then we are going to get into some Patriots talk. Nick Fitzy-Stevens will be joining us not too long from now. But before we get to any of that, it is time to trend with Tom Crisafulli. Back here on WEEI, I'm John Lyons. Got Tom Crisafulli, producer behind the glass. We'll be joined shortly by the one and only Nick Fitzy-Stevens. Before that, though, we just finished talking Celtics. If you missed any of it, the Odyssey app is free. Apple Podcasts, LimeWire, wherever you get your sports radio. I don't even know if LimeWire is still legal, but yeah, if you go there, you can find us, you can find me, and all that Celtics talk. But I want to talk some Bruins here. They get their first win under interim coach Joe Sacco, 1-0. It's a power play goal scored by Elias Lindholm, who felt like it almost felt like he was never going to score again, to be honest. This Bergeron light that they signed in the offseason, and I'm not trying to be unkind to the guy, was a supporter of the signing, but that was only his third goal of the season, only 10 total points so far this year for a guy that has been a top-tier center in the NHL for the last several years and won 56% of his faceoffs last year. So hopefully this helps him get back on track, maybe even more so than the coaching change, right? You just need these players to play better, and I know that's a cliche, but you just need the players to play better. Bruins still only 1 of 7 on the power play. Did feel like they were much better defensively in this game, though. And Jonas Korpisalo, 22 save shutout in this one. And it felt like, look, not that Utah had no high danger chances, but it just felt like the Bruins defensively limited things much more than they had in recent games. I was at the Blue Jackets game on Monday night, and I'll tell you, I've been to several great Bruins games. I was at Game 3 of the 2011 Cup Final, Game 1 of the 2019 Cup Final, right? I've been at some great ones, and I bring that up to say, I've been to my share of bad ones. That was one of the worst. I went to a game a couple years ago where they lost to Carolina 6-0 at home, but that was also because I think they had 3 or 4 guys, including Bergeron, out with COVID, and it was like a rescheduled game that should have happened earlier in the year. This one, they had everyone. Blue Jackets weren't a good team, and they still got smoked. That was just a miserable, miserable environment, to say the least. But they rebound. They get their first win under Joe Sacco. And look, KJ and I talked about this quite a bit Wednesday night. Look, the coaching change, sure, it'll help. But these guys got to look around. The players in the front office, and Don Sweeney kind of alluded to this in his media availability after the coaching change, but like these guys got to look around. I mean, they're on their fourth coach in the last 10 years. Is it really the coach? I mean, Claude Julien won a Stanley Cup, went to another. They fired him on Patriots Parade Day. Bruce Cassidy went to Game 7 of a Cup Final. They fire him. Then he goes and, by the way, wins a cup somewhere else that same year. Ooh, that still hurts me. Then you have Jim Montgomery, right? Has the best regular season ever. I thought did a terrible job in that Florida Panthers series in 2023. Was one of the reasons they lost. So, in fairness, that was bad. But then he rebounds, has a better year last year. They still fire him after the bad start this year. So now with Joe Sacco, you're on your fourth head coach in the last 10 years. Meanwhile, you've had the same GM. And look, let's look at the facts here. Peter Chiarelli got run out of this town after 9 years. In those 9 years, he went to 2 Stanley Cup finals, he won a championship, and they won a separate President's Trophy in 2014 and lost in a second-round Game 7 to Montreal, which still also bothers me. But point being, in 9 years, he went to 2 Cups, won one, and won a separate President's Trophy. Don Sweeney's resume doesn't match that. And I'm not going to get on Don Sweeney for the Bruins losing Game 7 of the Cup Final at home against St. Louis. I mean, you can't get on the GM for that. I mean, come on. Although I will say a sneaky important part of that postseason was Columbus sweeping Tampa in the first round. I don't know if the Bruins get there if Tampa doesn't get swept. So they were a great team that year. I don't know if they were an elite, elite team. And then he built the team in 2023 that was the best team in the NHL, and the players and the coach gagged it away in the first round. So I'm not going to blame Sweeney for those 2 years. I'm not. I think it's ridiculous to blame him for those 2 years. But you look at the other 7 years or 8 years, including this one, I mean, have they been good enough? I mean, they had what? A second round loss to Tampa Bay in 2018. Second round loss to Tampa Bay in the bubble in 2020. Was it a second round loss in 21 to the Islanders? First round loss in 22 to Carolina? Like, they're not even getting to the conference final in these other years. Whereas, again, Peter Chiarelli, he had, what, multiple, I think it was three second round game seven losses, plus he went to two cup finals. Sweeney's resume just doesn't match that. Yet we ran Peter Chiarelli out of town. And I'm not even saying Chiarelli should not have lost his job at the end. I mean, there was some questionable moves there. The Sagan trade, the Boychuk trade, overextending some of his own guys. So I'm not even sitting here advocating that Peter Chiarelli should have kept his job for life. I'm just saying, if Peter Chiarelli's going to get run out of town, his resume's a lot better than Don Sweeney's. And if you follow the Bruins, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm not sitting here telling you Sweeney has sucked, but Chiarelli had a better resume, and he got run out of town. Now you're on your fourth head coach in 10 years. And I mentioned before, too, where are the players in this? I mean, you fire the coach, you win 1-0 over Utah, who's a team with a losing record, right? I think they were 6-9-3 coming into that game. So a team with a losing record. You beat them 1-0, but you're 1-of-7 on the power play. It's more about Korpisalo and your defense having a pretty good night. But at what point are these players going to be held more accountable? I mean, if the Bruins come out in these next 4 or 5 games, maybe 6 games, and they go 2-4 in their next 6, they should be looking at making a major trade. I mean, you went to Game 7 of the Cup Final in 19. Then you went to Game 7 of the first round. You choked away with a great team in 23. And I bring that up again because there are several guys that were on those teams that are still here that have not stepped up enough, I think, especially from a leadership standpoint. Now, Marchand, look, he's your captain. I'm not going to necessarily question his leadership. He's won a cup, all that. I'm talking about the other guys. Because when the Bruins went to the cup final in 2019, you had Chara as the captain, but you had Bergeron, you had Krejci. Marchand obviously was still there as a leadership-wise, kind of a secondary voice, if you will. You had Tuukka Rask, even guys that had been through it, guys that had leadership qualities, guys that led by example or by voice. And in 2023 even, I know Char and Rask are gone, right? But you still have Bergeron, still have Krejci. You had Nick Foligno, who's been a captain in the NHL. You had other leaders on that team. Now, okay, you have Marchand, but does it feel like Pasternak, McAvoy, Carlo, have they stepped up enough from a leadership void? Like, I'm not saying they've sucked, but does McAvoy look like the Norris Trophy defenseman every night that his contract says he should be? It doesn't feel that way. I mean, Pasternak goes, what, the entire game against Columbus and doesn't shoot the puck? Like, that's I think, one of the issues at play here is the secondary leadership on, and again, Pasternak's top 5 forward in the NHL. I'm not trying to dump on the guy here, but I think it was easier for Pasternak to do his thing and McAvoy to do his thing when you had guys like Krejci and Chara and Bergeron who basically took care of the whole leadership mantle. Now, I mean, these guys are the vets. I mean, we can look at McAvoy as, okay, he's only been in the league 4 or 5 years. Yeah, he's a vet now. He's one of the leaders. Pasternak is the highest paid player on the team. Whether he likes it or not, and I don't know whether he likes it or not, he's one of the leaders. And it just feels like that beyond Brad Marchand, there's a secondary leadership void. And you used to also get leadership from your goaltending spot, whether it was Tim Thomas, Tuukka Rask. Now, you're not getting leadership from goaltending. And nothing against Swayman, but he's a young player, and a little bit against him. He bitched about his contract all summer and held out a training camp. And Korpisalo's obviously, and he shouldn't be a leader, right? He's a backup goalie. So I feel like that's a sneaky major issue on this team. And if I'm Don Sweeney, and I look to shake up this roster, if they, let's say, don't rebound and go, you know, or go 2-4 over their next 6 games, or go 6-6 over their next 12, I look at adding someone who's a legit leader to go along with Marchand. And don't be shocked if a real piece off this roster goes the other way in the trade, whether it's McAvoy, Carlo, whoever. I sure as hell wouldn't trade Pasternak, but I know people have talked about that. But it just feels like, to me, there's a secondary leadership void. And maybe Elias Lindholm can be that guy. He has the power play goal on Thursday night which, again, only goal in a 1-0 win. Hopefully that snaps him out of his funk, but you can't come in and be a leader when you're a free agent signing who has 2 goals up until Thursday night. It's just you can't be that guy. When your role is to be a good offensive piece, Bergeron light, if you will, you can't be a leader if you're not performing. And I think that's been the issue. And same thing with Jeremy Swayman. I mean, you can't really be a leader when you hold out a training camp, come back and play as one of the worst goalies in the NHL. And I'm hoping he can rebound, right? I'm a Bruins fan. I want to see them win. I'm hoping he can. But it just, I think there was a lot of criticism of Jim Montgomery, and I think some of it was fair, especially that first round against Florida. Some of it wasn't. But I think the bigger issues at play, I mean, we're a fourth head coach here in Boston in the last 10 years. The bigger issue at play is this front office and this roster, because they've assembled talent in that locker room. But so far this year, it hasn't fit together. Bruins are 9-9-3. That's a losing record. Okay, I know it's only 9-9 in regulation, or a few other 9 regulation losses, but I include those overtime losses because you lose a playoff game in overtime, it's just a loss, right? So you have a losing record at 9-9-3. You're way too talented to have a losing record. And maybe I overrated the Bruins to start this year. I thought they could get to the conference final because I looked at it and said, well, they took the Stanley Cup champs to 6 games. They have a great young goalie. They add Zadorov, who, by the way, I mean, the only thing he's really helped the Bruins with is lead the league in penalty minutes, which they are as a team. So maybe he'll bounce back, but I thought adding Zadorov, adding Lindholm, another year for some of these young players. I thought maybe Patro would contribute. Maybe Lysell would contribute. And it's just none of that has worked out. And I guess the silver lining is absolutely none of that has worked out. And the Bruins are still right there in the thick of the playoff race. So if the playoffs started today, I think the Bruins would be the first team out. So they're at 21 points. But they're right there within range. But again, this is a talented team. They have the second worst goal differential in the Eastern Conference at minus 20. So the front, okay, you can fire the coach, but I'm telling you, if they go 2-4 in their next 6, even if they go 6-6 in their next 12, then I think you need to make a major trade here. And Sweeney better get it right, because if they make a major trade and he doesn't get it right and this team doesn't bounce back, then the Bruins should be looking for a new GM next summer. And I hate to have to say that, because, you know, someone who's worked in sports, worked in the coaching world, I hate to say, oh, someone should lose their job. I think people in this industry are way too freaking casual about how they say, oh, so-and-so should be fired and so-and-so should lose their job. But look, like I said, Peter Chiarelli got run out of this town, and his resume is better than Don Sweeney's. There's been players who have been run out of this town and traded away who had better resumes than some of the guys on the Bruins now that are performing. So, yeah, okay, you fire the coach, you get your first win. That's good. I mean, I was happy Thursday night. I was. But, I mean, I look at this next stretch coming up for the Bruins, and you have Detroit tonight, Vancouver Tuesday. Got games against Pittsburgh, Montreal later on. Your winnable games, Chicago game. Like, there's winnable games coming up. A Philly game, December 7th. There are winnable games coming up. So can the Bruins beat these teams they should beat, and can they avoid the weekly embarrassment loss? And what I mean by the weekly embarrassment loss, right? Basically, once a week since late October, they've gotten blown out at least one time. Nashville, October 22nd, 4-0 loss to a team at the time that was winless. Brutal loss. Just over a week later on Halloween, 8-2 loss to Carolina. About, what, a week and not quite a week later, 4-0 loss in Toronto. About a week and a half after that, November 14th, 7-2 to Dallas. Then 4 days later, 5-1 against Columbus, boom, coach is fired. So that's what I want to see. Can they avoid the weekly embarrassing loss? Can they actually string together some wins against teams that they are more talented than? Because if not, I mean, the Montgomery change is the tip of the iceberg. I'm so aggravated I couldn't even get my words out there. But, again, they did win. So I know I'm on sports radio, so I'm not trying to be all negative. They did win, but it's just, again, I am dubious. I hope Joe Sacco's the answer, but just based off what I've seen over the last 10 years, and especially so far this year, I'm dubious. But we will see. We're going to switch and talk some. We're going to switch and talk some Patriots coming up next. There's some interesting thoughts here. Some controversy on the Hall of Fame. Robert Kraft didn't get in. There's some other Patriots from the dynasty who are eligible to get in. We're going to talk all that and more with Nick Fitzy-Stevens coming up right after this break.
Just a couple of fortunate sons talking Patriots football on a crisp autumn Saturday here on Boston Sports Original 93.7 FM WEEI. Apologies for being a little bit late to the party, but happy to be here with you. It was the Underscore and Lions show for the first 30 minutes today following Boston College football, and that was John Lyons. A big old dub for Bill O'Brien and company, who have done a very impressive job. I won't say turning that program around, but getting the most out of the BC Eagles and the talent that they have right there. They are far from your Colorado Buffaloes or your Ohio State Buckeyes or even your decrepit Michigan Wolverines at this point, but they are bowl eligible 41-21 over Drake May's alma mater, USC. We actually have some audio from the UNC head coach Mac Brown that we want to share with you later on in the program that our own Tommy Freeze Pops just pulled and sent our way a few minutes ago. Great job on the Hockey Talk and your Boston Celtics. Couldn't agree with you more, John Lyons, that winning a game that you should have won easily, that you actually end up struggling with, but pull away in the end the way that they did, the manner in which the Celtics brought home that W Friday night was impressive for them, even though obviously they're going up against a little bit of a tire fire of a team in the Washington Wizards. But hey, you don't get to make the schedule. I also don't understand WTF the NBA Cup is all about. But that was a big win for them last night. And now we turn our attention to tomorrow's big game, 1 o'clock, not in South Beach. It's a common misconception that the Dolphins, everyone likes to say, takes their talents to South Beach or refer to it as South Beach. But it's actually Miami Gardens, where the former Margaritaville / J-Lo and Jimmy Buffett Stadium, now known as Hard Rock Stadium, a.k.a. the Patriots' House of Horrors. Tomorrow you got Drake May in his first game in the Patriots' House of Horrors, 1 o'clock against Mike McDaniel, the Vape King, the tracksuit, Tua Tagovailoa, Tyreek Hill, and the Miami Dolphins. John, when I call it a House of Horrors for the New England Patriots, do you know what the team's record is in doing my research and prep for this week's Sunday 7, published tomorrow morning at WEEI.com? Cheap plug. Do you know what the Patriots' record is against the Miami Dolphins in the state of Florida?
Overall, or like in the last 20 years?
Overall.
Oof. I bet you, so what's it been, 60 seasons or whatever?
Yeah, approximately 60 seasons, yes.
I bet they have 25 wins.
Wow, you gave them way more credit than they deserve.
I was going to say 20, and I added 5.
That would have been too many as well. They are 16-42 in the state of Miami. Excuse me, the state of Florida against the Dolphins.
Wow, okay. And you know what, I was just thinking too, like, if you think back to the dynasty years, it's easier to remember the games they won down in Miami than all the games they lost at. Because they won in 2003 down there, 2007,
yep.
I think 2011 on a Monday night, opening night. It's
I was there, side note, in 2011, that Monday nighter. It was about 95 degrees, pitch black still, yep, when it got dark and they started the game. It was the hottest, most humid, unbelievably swamp-tastic, swastastic, yeah, game that I've ever been to in my life. Watching the Welker 99-yard touchdown IRL was just such a thing of beauty. Just truly one of the highlights of my live sporting life.
There were Super Bowl-winning Patriots. Like, I think the 04 Patriots team is the best team they've ever had in Foxborough. And
they lost
down in Miami, right? The 2014 team, which I think is a top two or three team the Patriots have ever had, they lost down in Miami in week one after having a 10-point halftime lead. So,
oh, that was a terrible one. And do you remember the 2004 game?
33-20.
Yep, the 2004 game. Yeah, they just got their doors blown off after they got out to an early lead. And ultimately, obviously, that season worked out pretty well for them.
Yeah.
Thank you, Malcolm Butler. But if you remember the 2004 game, that's where Brady threw an ass pass that was intercepted, and that killed them on the Monday night.
I'm sure you remember this, Fitzy, but he did that earlier in the year in a game against Cincinnati, and it worked.
Yes.
And then he tried it again against Miami, and it definitely did not work. And that was like one of four times ever the Dolphins wore orange for like a jersey for a night game or whatever. It was some weird stat like that. But yeah, that's the thing. We can remember, like, I remember in 2007, they won 49-28. Moss had those two amazing catches. I can remember 2003, the overtime win. You know, what was it, 2011, the one you just talked about? Like, we can remember the ones they won down there specifically because there were so few times that they actually won down there. Again, Super Bowl champion Patriots teams. I think it was, what, 2017 when they lost in the Super Bowl, but they went down to Miami and lost to Jay Cutler on a Monday night down there.
Oh, like, they didn't lose. They got their ass handed to them in that game against Jay Cutler and I forget the name of that short little running back slash receiver.
2016, they actually won down there because Michael Floyd had that amazing block late in the game. And then 2018,
Michael Floyd absolutely ruined somebody in that. Yeah, that was an absolute smashing. And also, you remember 2018?
Miami Miracle.
That was still, why to this date, when they knew they weren't going to be throwing a Hail Mary, or at least they thought there was going to be a Hail Mary, why Gronk was back there when his back was hurting and he was physically compromised? He could probably barely have gotten off his feet to knock a pass down toward there to have been a Hail Mary. That season, that 2018 ended in a Super Bowl and a championship the way they were able to pivot. It's that kind of intelligence. It's that kind of, and this is one of the key adjectives and descriptives of the Gerard Mayo, or so we were told thus far, John, collaborative effort by the team. Brady checking the ego at the door, being willing to pass less and run more. A fresh running back in Sony Michel. Yes, they took the wrong Georgian running back in the draft, but still, he had good legs that season. The offensive line's continuity. Josh McDaniels scrapping the whole season's game plan and turning them into a power run and play action team. Absolutely.
Jones covering Tyreek Hill in the AFC Championship game and shutting him down.
One of their Kyle Van Noy and Dont'a Hightower being unstoppable in three straight games from... Yeah. And, of course, the referees getting involved in the second half of the Chiefs game as well, which made it a little closer than it probably should have been.
It was
just truly remarkable. Anyway, now, we're in a different era. This is Drake May's first trip down to Miami Gardens, to Hard Rock Stadium, to take on a Miami Dolphins team that actually, John, I had a chance a couple days ago to speak with Mike Oliva, the host of Dolphins Talk, a very popular Miami Dolphins podcast. He was our guest on Six Rings. And he said the biggest thing that he's noticed about the Dolphins the last month since Tua came back and just sort of overall is that the tracksuit king, Mr. McGruber himself, Mike McDaniel, is actually evolving and, dare I say, showing signs of maturity. He is going from a fancy play caller who has his on-field antics and does stand up at the podium before and after the game to a legitimate head coach. He's benching people. He's cutting guys. He's making hard choices. They're switching to a bit more of a running team themselves now. They've got great depth at running back, obviously. Raheem Mostert wasn't performing well, so now Devon Achane is the starter. Jalen Wright's been elevated to the second string running back. Great pick by them. Fourth round steal last year back in April. That's how you weaponize an offense, Elliot Wolf. I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but that was a great pick for them. And now Mostert is the third string running back. They're not going to blow you away by any stretch. The way that people used to look forward to it. And, you know, some of it may have had to have done with the point of emphasis and the crackdown on a lot of the pre-snap motion that Miami was famous for the last couple of years. But they're evolving appropriately. So you're going to get a little bit of a different Miami team tomorrow. I'm curious how you think the Patriots will try and defend a Miami team that should, on reputation, be dangerous with the pass and Tyreek and Waddle, who is on the side of milk cartons in the Miami area more than he is on fantasy rosters and the stat sheet and box score. He's having a brutal season. They're better running the ball these days than they are passing. Should have had a win against them earlier this year. This is Drake's first game against them. How do you see tomorrow, just like from an initial glance, shaking out?
It's funny because you mentioned Mike McDaniel, and earlier this year, Fitzy, I was disappointed in him because I felt like when Tua went down, they didn't do a good enough job adjusting because you still had Waddle, you still had Hill, and they couldn't get anything going. They did enough to beat the Patriots, I know, earlier this year, but they couldn't get anything going on offense. Now, of course, they have Tua back, so that's a moot point. But I do feel that Mike McDaniel's grown a little bit over the course of this season, so maybe a good sign for Miami, but... Look, I think this is going to be, to me, a big coverage game because you mentioned Hill and Waddle and now Tua's back and Achane out of the backfield. I think a key player in this one, Fitzy, is Marcus Jones because he's your maybe best overall athlete now. Like I mentioned earlier, Jonathan Jones covering Tyreek Hill in the AFC Championship game in 18. I love Jonathan Jones, favorite player on the team, but I think, look, he's been in the league, what, 8-9 years now. I think Marcus Jones may have surpassed him as the best overall athlete on the team. And that's, I would consider sticking him either on a hill or Waddle, more so a hill for the speed factor, with maybe a safety over the top and see if he can hang there and have Christian Gonzalez, say, on Jalen Waddle wherever he goes on the field. So I think this could be a sneaky big Marcus Jones game, but it comes down to me, the defensive backs, and I thought the defensive backs, especially, again, Jonathan Jones, did not play well against the Rams. And part of it, I think they got a little bit out-schemed by Sean McVay, credit to him. But they also didn't play well. Jonathan Jones talked about that after the game. So can that unit as a whole bounce back, play really well, and Marte Mapu might have a bigger role still? I don't know if he'll be back yet or not. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think this is a big game for the Patriots' defensive backs.
It's a huge game for the Pats' defensive backs, especially now considering all the other defensive backs. Because Christian Gonzalez popped up on the injury report
yesterday.
Questionable with a hip. That's not great, and especially when he's going up against the Christian Gonzalez Admiration Society, that is Tyreek Hill, who hasn't said it. The only person on the Patriots, maybe in the AFC East, having more flowers lobbed his way than Drake May, who is just the belle of the ball and the toast of the town, the Orlovskys and the McVays and the Warners and the McDaniels. Everybody can't stop saying enough nice things about Drake May. And in my estimation, it's valid and warranted. But they love them some Christian Gonzalez down in Miami. Even Garrett Wilson this week was on a podcast, and when he wasn't complaining about being stuck on the Jets like everyone else, he was talking about how good he thinks Christian Gonzalez is. So if he's compromised tomorrow, this is going to stress out Alex Austin, who's back. Marco Wilson was released earlier this week. Marcus Jones, who I'm a big fan of as well, both in terms of his overall athleticism. And I think his coverage is actually, you know, decent as well. He was great in college, missed all of last year. It is. Hart always busts my chops and says, I'm not really sure about that. I think he's over it. I don't think he's very good. Like, well, it's not bad. Don't forget, this is his sophomore season in the NFL. He missed all of 2023. So not only do you have to come back from the injury, but you got to get back to where you were at the end of 2022 when he was playing at a very high level, kick return touchdown, offensive touchdown, pick six as well, covered Devontae Adams in the infamous backwards Jacoby Myers lateral game in Las Vegas and did a damn good job as well. Had the pick six against the Bengals on Christmas Eve. Marcus Jones is good. And, you know, John Jones didn't play well early, had a nice breakup towards the end of the game last week that gave the Patriots a chance. They're going to get stressed tomorrow if Miami does try to pass the ball. But I'm concerned about the run game. Like, maybe this is where, John, maybe this is where tomorrow we get a little excited about the trench warfare, because maybe another weekend there was video that was shared on social media earlier this week. Christian Barmore was dancing around, jumping. He looked a little more spry. It wasn't like, oh, man, what do I do back here? Ooh, I'm sore. Wow, I forgot how much this hurts. Like, he looks like he may start to be rounding back into football shape a little bit. Maybe he'll play more snaps tomorrow. I think he could play a huge part in the Patriots keeping this game close.
Yeah, and I think a huge thing here, and this goes with the secondary and with Barmore, and also let's not forget Dietrich Wise missed last week's game. Is he going to be able to come back? He's questionable. But one thing that killed them against the Rams was the amount of big plays they gave up early in drives, Fitzy.
Mm-hmm.
The Rams had 10 total drives if you include the final kneel down. Do you want to take a guess at how many times the Rams, on either the first or second play of a drive, had a play of 10 or more yards?
I'm going to guess double digits.
So they were 8 out of 10. They had a play of 10-plus yards within the first two plays of a drive, whether it was a 37-yard pass on the second play of their first drive. Of course, they had the 69-yard touchdown pass to open the second half. That was on the second play of a drive. They had another 12-yard touchdown pass on the first play of a drive. So the Patriots, what killed them defensively against the Rams is every single time, almost every single time the Rams started a drive, they were getting a chunk play. And the easiest way to score is to start a drive with a chunk play, whether it was that 69-yard touchdown or something as simple as they had a 10-yard run to open up their fifth drive. Right? Like, the Patriots' defense got smoked early in drives, and I think a lot of that is credit to Sean McVay. It felt like whenever he opened a drive against the Patriots, he had something to keep them off balance. But they also got out-physical. They also didn't make plays. And you look at an offense like Miami, you mentioned it. Tyreek Hill, Jalen Waddle, Devon Achane. Now the two is back. That's a team capable of getting chunk plays at any time. So can the Patriots' defense limit those chunk plays, especially early in drives? But can they limit them overall? Because as much as we like Drake May, as much as he's shown so far this year, do you really want him getting in a shootout with Tyreek Hill, Jalen Waddle, and Tua down in Miami on the road? Like, I don't think that's a good spot for the Patriots to be in. So can their defense limit some of these chunk plays, which just, frankly, that's what killed them against the Rams? If they had only had half that many, Fitzy, I bet the Patriots would have beat the Rams.
Yeah, and also, the Rams only had 8 third downs in the whole damn game. They were so successful on first and second down. Yeah.
Like, that in itself is crazy.
But Pat's defense coming off of John. Do you think maybe they sniffed their own blank, or they read their clippings coming off the 9-sack effort dominating the Bears the week before?
It's possible. I think the bigger thing though was Chicago's offensive operation was just in disarray. I mean, they fired their offensive coordinator the day after the game, right? So, and you were there, Fitzy, in Chicago. You saw it live.
Mm-hmm.
They had to fire their offensive coordinator, and that's a Chicago offense with some of the guys they have. Should be a heck of a lot better than they are. And they seem to bounce back in their first game with a new coordinator last week, at least a little bit. But point is, I think that was part of it. Chicago was in disarray. But I think the other part of this, and I said it before the game, and I wasn't alone in saying it, but Sean McVay and that Rams staff was the best, being Doug Peterson. McVay, one of the best coaches in the NFL. And I just think they got out-coached and they got out-schemed when the Patriots were on defense. And Mike McDaniel, he's not as good a coach as Sean McVay, but he is pretty good when it comes to scheming things offensively. So I'm sure he saw some things McVay and the Rams did, especially in some of those passing plays, those passing chunk plays, and he's going to try to take some of that. So maybe they were a little high on themselves, but I think it was more, hey, the Bears were really bad 2 weeks ago, and I just think they got flat out out-schemed by Sean McVay when they were on defense.
Yeah, we'll see if the Patriots respond by not. Again, a lot of this will probably depend on Christian Gonzalez's health as well. Because if he's not well, or if he's definitely compromised, legitimately injured, then he may have to play boundary corner in this quarter. They may be forced to play zone because it's going to be tough to man up Tyreek Hill, Waddle, and the resurgence of the unstoppable juggernaut. That is Jonnu Smith. My word, how have they been able to unlock the levels?
I wish the Patriots could get guys like that.
Yeah, full Bob LaBelle voice. Hey, how come we can't get guys like that? This is who he was supposed to be when they paid him a ton of... Anyway, 617-779-7937 is your telephone number. I see your calls lined up. We will get right to those as soon as we come back. When we come back as well, we'll get a little bit more into our preview of tomorrow's game, take a look at Week 12, and the week that was for Jerod Mayo, and why my confidence is shaken organizationally right now. And no, it's not in the fact that they have a rookie quarterback. And no, it's not in the fact that he doesn't have a lot of weapons, assets, or elite playmakers around him as well. John and I will get into that in the 5 o'clock hour coming up. It's Fitzy and Lyons here on WEEI.